Going to introduce the chair of our Fair Practices Committee, Barbara Salka, who will introduce our guest today.
Thanks, Mike. We didn't actually bill this as a Fair Practices session, but this is coming to you courtesy of the Fair Practices Committee. So I'm going to take the opportunity to introduce our speaker. One of the singular advantages of meeting in Chapel Hill is that it's home to our next speaker, who graciously agreed to take an hour of her very busy schedule to talk to us and answer questions on the ever-perplexing arena of copyright law. Laura Gassaway is director of the Law Library and professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill School of Law, where she teaches courses on intellectual property and cyberspace law. She's a speaker who is much in demand, and I know some of you in the audience have actually heard her speak at other professional meetings. She talks on a number of topics, and she's also an acknowledged expert in the evolving issues surrounding our particular interest, which is media copyright. She's written numerous articles and co-authored the book Librarians and Copyright, A Guide to Copyright in the 1990s, published in 1994, and she also edited Growing Pains and Adapting Copyright for Education. Well, it's Growing Pains, I'm sorry, misread that. Growing Pains, Adapting Copyright for Education, Libraries, and Society. That was published in 1997. We're very fortunate to have Professor Gassaway join us this afternoon, so please give her a warm welcome. She's going to do her presentation. There will be time for questions afterwards. She's promised that she will give some time for that. So please welcome Professor.
Preservation, which of course has been a continuing issue, and there's some new legislation specifically there. Also then talk about the internet and the World Wide Web, because I think that's where many of us are doing our work now, thinking about mounting that work. So we'll talk about the use of recorded music, look at the MP3 and Napster controversies, and talk a little bit about the future. Not that I know what's going to happen, but a little bit about it. So that kind of gives you an overview of what I thought we would talk about during the hour that's been allotted to me. We're about 10 minutes late starting, and I know you will want a break, so I'll try to talk fast. I guess that's the best thing I can do. Copyright is the legally secured right to publish and sell the substance and form of a literary, artistic, or musical work. It protects the form of expression, not facts or ideas. We are looking for two things in copyright before a work is protected. The first one is originality, and embodied in that is at least a little bit of creativity. Doesn't take much, just a smidgen of creativity is enough. Originality doesn't mean it in the normal English language usage of the term. What it means is you didn't copy it from someone else. It's a very straightforward, simple definition in copyright law. The second requirement is that the work be fixed in tangible medium of expression, now known or later developed. So from the time it is put on audio tape, written out in longhand, etc., the work is protected. So it is from that point that we have federal copyright protection attaching. One may register the work for copyright with the U.S. Copyright Office, but it is not mandatory. It became voluntary beginning in 1978 with the effective date of the current act. There are some important benefits that a copyright owner gets from registration, like the ability to file suit in federal court, the ability to recover certain damages, and the ability to recover attorney's fees, ever popular in the copyright arena. When one registers a work, you deposit two copies of the best edition with the Copyright Office. And the Copyright Office is a part of the Library of Congress. And that's actually how we've built the Library of Congress collection of U.S. imprints, is through that copyright deposit requirement. There are very detailed regulations on exactly what you deposit if the work you're producing is not a book or a sound recording. If it's a three-dimensional work, for example, or an electronic database or software, there are regulations on exactly what you deposit. Sort of the opposite of copyright is the public domain, and I think that is especially important to scholars and researchers, and I think to you specifically. There are three types of work in the public domain. First of all, material on which the copyright has expired. Secondly, materials in which the author either never claimed copyright or which were dedicated to the public. Now, that's another term of art in copyright law because it means that you published the work under the 1909 Act and you failed to include a notice of copyright. So you screwed up and lost your rights, is what it really means. But it says dedicated to the public, which I like because it sounds very high-minded. And the last category, materials produced by the federal government. Section 105 of the Copyright Act simply says that if a work is produced by the feds, they may not hold copyright in that work. So we sort of have the opposite. Now, one of the things that I created some years ago is a chart called When Works Pass into the Public Domain. And it's not straightforward. I mean, I hope the chart is, but the answer to the question is not straightforward. I have a feeling some of you have done some research on trying to look at these works and determine when they have passed into the public domain. Sound recordings, as you know, were not protected until 1972, so we're kind of looking at a little bit of a difference with those, but I've given you the URL where you can find this chart so you don't have to try to copy it down. You're welcome to use the chart, reprint it, do whatever you want to with it, but I ask you to include the URL so that anyone who sees the chart knows where to go for updates, because there are off and on some updates. If the work was created after January 1 of 1978, the term is now life of the author plus 70 years. If it is a work of corporate authorship, so that it is the record company that is claiming copyright, it is 95 years after date of first publication or 120 years after creation, whichever comes first. It is a very long time. When you begin to think about how long that is, that really means virtually nothing that's produced during your lifetime will pass into the public domain while you're still alive. You know, if someone produces something when you're 10 years old and then they live for 40 more years, that means 50 plus 70, you'd have to live to be 120 before the work would pass into the public domain. So it is a very long, pardon? And the chances of that are a little slim still, but we do see a few people living very long times. That is one of the great concerns about this life plus 70. If the work was published prior to 1923, it is now in the public domain, meaning no copyright. We may all do what we want to with it. You can re-record it, reissue it, etc. If the work was published between 1923 and 1963, it received 28 years of copyright protection. At the end of that period, the copyright owner had to apply for an extension of copyright and got an additional 47 years. Congress 2 years ago tacked 20 more years onto that, so they got an additional 67 years. What should have happened at the end of 1978 was that all of the works from 1923 should have gone into the public domain. But because of the Copyright Term Extension Act and the fact that it was retroactive, it will be 2019 before anything else goes into the public domain. I think that is of great concern to scholars and researchers. The big companies who were in favor of this were, interestingly, not so much publishers or record companies, but the movie studios, especially Disney Studios, pushed very hard for the extension of copyright for an additional 20 years. Mickey Mouse, as portrayed in Steamboat Willie, would have gone into the public domain in 2003. And so Disney was worried about that. I'm not quite sure why, because Mickey Mouse in Steamboat Willie looks exactly like a rat and not much like the Mickey Mouse of today. Plus, Disney holds trademark rights of the Disney characters, too. So I find this a little bit odd. So I always say, pardon?
Greed.
Yeah, we sacrifice the public domain for scholars and researchers for that damn mouse, is usually the way I sort of refer to it. And Disney has more money than God anyway, so I'm not sure, you know, exactly what it was they were trying to protect, since they had trademark rights in any event. In 1992, there was another amendment to the Act that said we're going to stop copyright renewals. And so for works that were published between 1964 and 1977, they automatically got that additional 67 years. So that's why this chart becomes important. You have to do some tracing back on these items to make some decisions. The last two rows on the chart deal with unpublished works. And I would assume that many of the recordings you are dealing with would be considered unpublished. Many of them would be. And so this is important to you. When a work was unpublished under the 1909 Copyright Act, the previous act, it never passed into the public domain. It never got federal copyright protection. It was in something called common law copyright, but it never passed into the public domain either. And so Congress set a date at which time these works will pass into the public domain. And if the work was published as of January 1 of 1978 and remained unpublished through the end of 2002, it will pass into the public domain on that day or life of the author plus 70 years, whichever is greater. So it's going to be a big year for archival collections because a whole lot of that stuff is going to go into the public domain at the end of 2002. Things like manuscripts, unpublished recordings, photographs, a lot of things will go into the public domain on that day. If the work was created before January 1 of 78, but it does get published between then and the end of 2002, Congress gave them some more years, 2047 or life plus 70, whichever is greater. Now, I realize I won't still be a librarian in 2047. If I'm here, I won't be still be a librarian. So I'm not going to have to worry about that last box much. But 2002 is almost here. And that's going to make a significant difference about what is available in the public domain, and no more permissions have to be sought. One of the things I thought we might look at is the difference in the statutory definition between phonorecord, which is used repeatedly in the copyright statute. Anytime it says you may make a copy of a work, it says copy or phonorecord, and the sound recording. The definitions are similar. You may have looked at these, but when I was asked to do this, I thought, well, that's sort of interesting. I wonder why they are treated differently. It comes from the definition section of the Act, section 101. Usually what we think of is that a phonorecord is whatever material object it is fixed in, and the sound recording is the result of the fixation. Why they use the two different terms, I'm not positive, except that in Europe, phonorecord continues to be used. And when I say this to my students today, they go, why in the world would you call it a phonorecord? Remember, there were records. Two of my students in cyberspace law were doing their project this year on the MP3, and they said, you know how great it's going to be? You'll be able to just record a single song, and you'll be able to play just a single song. And I said, you know, I think those were called 45s in my day. Even before, or wax cylinders, right. And so they thought this was a whole new thing. And you went, no, not quite new. But nonetheless, different for our students of today's generation. Well, what's different in copyright about sound recordings? Well, as I mentioned, they were not protected under Federal Copyright Act until 1972. There are still no general performance rights for sound recordings. You probably know this, that when records are played on the radio, the royalties go to the composer, not to the record company or the musicians who are doing the performance. There is a new exception to that, though. A recent addition to the Act added, except for digital transmission of sound recordings. This was put in specifically to get the MP3 folks, and so far they're being successful with doing that. That if what you have is digital transmission of a sound recording, then there is a performance right, but it is limited only to that digital transmission, which predominantly means on the web. Another thing that is different about sound recordings is that they are actually mentioned in the guidelines on the educational use of music. So there's a little bit of difference, I would say, just based on that. Now, the guidelines on the educational use of music are one of the two sets of guidelines that were negotiated in 1976 that accompanied the Act and were agreed upon by educational associations on one side and the music producers on the other side. Okay, let's, with that little background, then move on to look at the internet. And I want to talk more generally than just about sound recordings, because I think even if you are putting things on the web, sound recordings on the web, you're also interested in a little bit of text or something else. So let's talk about it more generally. Every time there's been new technology since I've been doing this work, which is now somewhere over 20 years, I'm always asked, what does it do to copyright? When CD-ROMs were new, I was asked that. So the question is, what does the internet do to copyright? And here's the creeping web that is my favorite graphic of all times. And it's an easy answer, nothing. The web doesn't do anything to copyright. The internet doesn't do anything to it. All of the underlying copyright concepts we were looking at remain the same. The only difference is it gives us a new method to infringe. That right capture button, you know, is really, really easy. I always say, you don't even have to leave your chair and go to the photocopier, you know, or to the tape duplicator. You're right there at your desk. So it's just a new method to infringe when it comes to copyright. That's the only thing that I can see that is a change. What happens when you put a work on the web, regardless of whether it's a sound recording or whether it is text, the result is mass reproduction. Certainly a copy is made when the work is scanned, input, or copied to send. But arguably a copy is also made by every person who even reads, views, or listens to the work on the computer. This sounds crazy, but the World Intellectual Property Organization has proposed that even copies in RAM count as copies for which we should have to compensate the copyright holder. There have been bills introduced in the United States going both ways, one saying yes, one saying no. Nothing has happened to that so far. But you should be aware that, at least on the international scene, there is a push to say even copies in computer RAM are copies that count. Now here are some internet particulars. The copyright still belongs to the author. The author can transfer it to a publisher or to someone else, just as they can in the analog world. There is no longer any requirement of notice. That happened in about 1989 when the US joined the Berne Convention in 1988. That was one of the first changes. So you no longer have to include the C in a circle or the P in a circle for phono records and the date. It's a good idea to do so often, but it's not a requirement. Even listserv submissions are copyrighted as long as they meet that originality requirement, which includes a smidgen of creativity.
78L.
I'm on a lot of listservs where it seems like half the people on it have to say, me too, attaboy, way to go. Doesn't make it. But even two or three sentences of intellectual contribution would count as long as there is some there, I guess we would say. Just because something is on the internet does not mean it's there by permission. I'm sure that in your field you all know that, but very often people will say, well, I found this on the internet, so it must mean that the copyright holder agreed for it to go there. No, not necessarily. One of the things that I think gets confusing for folks is to look at someone's website and find articles there. Now, I do hold the copyright on some of my articles, not on all of them, but on some. If you went to my website, you found my articles with my copyright notice, you could assume I gave myself permission to put them there. But the trouble is that I could take someone else's article, I could take Barbara's article, and not plagiarize it, but put her copyright notice even, but I've now mounted it on my web page. And certainly I infringe when I did that. But the bad news is you may have infringed when you used it there also. So we need to get much better at specifying how an item is put on the web and any restrictions on use. So I need to say, this is Barbara's article. She's given me permission to put it on my web page. She says any of you may use it for education and research purposes, but for anything else, go back to her. And I am starting to see more of that over the last 2 years than I did in the early days, especially with photographs you're seeing it. I don't know how often you're seeing it with music. Let's talk real specifically about the World Wide Web, because I think that's where we're seeing most of the material being posted today. Home pages are copyrighted. Yeah. As long as what you've done is some original work. You don't have to put a notice on any web pages you create, but it's a good idea to do so. Why? It alerts the world that someone is claiming copyright, and it tells them who to contact if they want to seek permission. So there's a lot of good reasons to do it. Now, it doesn't cut off the unscrupulous, but neither does anything else. So, you know, you're not going to, putting a notice won't stop anyone from taking your stuff, but it does stop those people who are in good faith. And the good news is the majority of people are in good faith. When you create a web page, as I said, original work is no problem. Anything that you have written, composed, taken the photograph, etc. The question we need to really focus on is whether when you use other people's copyrighted works, you need to get permission. And the best sort of rule of thumb I can give you is to assume you are publishing a book when you put it out on the web, that it is the equivalent of that, and try to determine whether a publisher would require you to get permission. Now, of course, we're just speculating, but we can kind of base this on, you know, yeah, okay, we'll try to figure this out. Suppose we're talking about text, and what you want to do is use three paragraphs out of a novel, and you're not going to plagiarize it, you're going to give the citation, so all you're doing is reproducing these three paragraphs on your web page. Would a publisher make you get permission for that? Some are saying yes, some are saying no. It really does depend. When I said three paragraphs out of a novel, the likelihood is no. If what you're producing is another scholarly work, it's probably fair use because of the very small percentage that you're using. But if it were three paragraphs out of a five-page article about sound recordings, then when you're looking at that amount and substantiality used, the answer is probably different, because maybe there's only 20 paragraphs, so you're using a much larger percentage. So you kind of judge that based on percentages. You know, one kind of text you always see permission having been sought and granted before it's used are song lyrics in novels. Yeah. Unless it's an old ballad that they don't really know either who wrote it or it's clearly in the public domain. I always say that I think the reason for that is because there are not very many words in especially modern songs, especially ones that are like, oh baby, oh baby, oh baby. You know, by the time you've used oh, you've used half the words there. So
originality.
That's right, probably not. Yeah, might not even meet the originality requirement. That's true. Photographs and graphics present different problems. What about using a photograph on your web page, a copyrighted photograph? Do you need permission for that? You bet. It's like you put the whole novel on your web page. Sure it is. I use graphics as a different example because of clip art specifically. Do you need permission to use clip art? Depends, that's right. That's a good lawyerly answer, by the way. But it's true, it does depend. Yeah, it does depend. I may be the only geek in the world who reads all the copyright notices I find, but I do read them. And when you see clip art on the web, you find a whole variety of things that are being claimed. You might see, I am the artist, I've created this, you're free to use it for nonprofit educational and research purposes. You might see I'm the artist, you're free to use two images for number three and beyond, it's $19.95 an image. You might see you're free to use it, just give me credit. In the big clip art collections, you often see, we've done our best to include clip art that is royalty free, but if we made a mistake and you use some of it, you're responsible. Should you worry about that? Again, it depends. If you are creating this web page for a nonprofit educational institution or you are an individual just doing it as a home page, it is no commercial purpose, etc., I don't think you need to worry about it very much. What would happen is you'd get a cease and desist letter, and that right button helps a lot. You get that letter, you click, it's gone, you know, so there's not much damage that has occurred to the copyright owner. However, if you have a commercial website, the answer is different. It's called the deep pocket rule in law. So, you know, if you're working for a company, the answer is different. But if you're doing it for an educational institution, a library, or I think even as an individual, you don't need to worry about it too much. Now, we've actually had our first clip art case. It's an interesting case. It wasn't just one piece of clip art, though. Mirobi is a software producer and had produced four CD-ROMs of clip art. And you could buy these CDs, and when you bought them, then you had the right to use pieces of it, you know, on your web pages, et cetera. The National Association of Fire Equipment Distributors had a website. I didn't know there was this association, but it convinced me there's a trade association for everything. So they do have one. On their website, their webmaster had placed a lot of clip art. Now, the way he got it was he belonged to a listserv that said, someone on the listserv said, we have a bunch of CDs of clip art. If you will send me blank discs, I'll copy them for you. So he did that and then uploaded them onto the association's webpage. The case was decided on motion for summary judgment, which goes about like this. Morobe created the software, the CDs, they registered the copyright in the clip art, you copied it, you lose. And then the judge took out after the webmaster and basically said, you idiot. You know, shouldn't you be suspicious when someone says we have four CDs of clip art? I've wondered if it was all fire-related clip art. Surely there can't be four CDs worth of fire-related clip art. But nonetheless, it is the only case we've had today. Think there could be that much? I think it was probably general, but the case really does not say. It just says clip art. So that's the only case we've had dealing specifically with clip art. Probably the hardest issue today is still motion media, and by that I mean movie clips, video clips, etc. The reason is that the people who produce these don't get it. When you ask them for permission, they are quoting fees that are astronomical. There is a consortium of community colleges in South Carolina, and the coordinators of distance learning in those institutions were doing an in-service training, so maybe there would have been a total of 30 people, I don't know, or 50 people. They sought permission to use 1 minute of a full-length film. They were quoted $10,000 for one-time use. There was a distance learning course being taught at a university in Indiana, a public university in Indiana, and they had 30 distance learning students. It was a closed course, you know, not out on the web or on television, and they sought permission to use 6 minutes of a full-length movie. One time, 30 students, protected environment, they were quoted the fee of $27,000 for the 6 minutes for one-time use. So I would be very, very careful with motion media right now, just because they're just not very good at it, giving permission yet. Now, there are CDs you can buy that have clips that you can use for putting on the web, and maybe I'd stick with that. Clearly, though, there is still fair use, but how much is fair use, I don't know, because one of the parts of fair use says if you use the heart of the work, it's too much. Now, in some movies, I can't tell you what the heart of the work is, but aren't there movies where when you hear the one line, it calls back everything about the movie, like, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, you know? That's just, you know, we automatically know, and I can see the scene, I can see how Clark Gable is standing, you know, so that's maybe the heart of Gone with the Wind, I don't know, but it may well be. So if you use what's the heart of the work, it will still be too much, according to the fair use test. So motion media is the hardest. Music, your predominant interest. For the first time this year in teaching my intellectual property class, when I went to some of the sites I had used last year as examples, I found this message, removed a courtesy of the Recording Industry of America. Yeah, it was nice of them to remove it, wasn't it? Yep. In other words, they've been after folks. They announced at the end of 1997 that they had a robot to search the web looking for infringement of their music and putting their records on. And that really ties right into the MP3 controversy. That's really what they've been doing. Now, I have heard representatives of ASCAP and BMI say, we don't worry about it if it's 10 seconds or less. If it's a very short clip, we don't worry about it. I have not heard the Recording Industry of America folks say that. I've not heard them disagree, but I haven't heard them come forward and say, if it's a short clip, we don't worry. The other thing they don't seem to care about is MIDI music. You know what MIDI music is? I think the reason they don't care is because it sounds so bad. I call it the elevator music of the new millennium. And they just don't seem to worry about it. And I think the reason is they can't imagine anyone like downloading the whole thing so that they can have, you know, the greatest MIDI hits or whatever. So they don't seem to care about that. With more historical music, one of the things I think you would have to make a decision on is, again, using a clip more than likely, and then looking to see, is the record company still around? Is it likely that there is anybody there to come after you? That sounds weird, but it's really true. That's what we do in law all the time, is risk assessment. And you know, it may be that when you're dealing with something that's old enough and you know that record company is long gone, that you're just willing to take the risk on it. Do remember, it may also be your institution's risk, though, if you're doing it for an institutional website. I do have a little bit better news about linking. Link away, that's no problem. Linking is the equivalent of a cross-reference, and you're perfectly free to link. You do want to make sure that you're linking to non-infringing websites. So, you know, you probably don't want to link to the one that says, we have 3,000 MP3 files up here for you of the most recent, 2 years of songs. Wouldn't link to that one, I don't think. But there are lots of sites that have what I call clean links, having nothing to do with pornography, but really speaking of free of copyright infringement. Government sites you can trust. Interestingly enough, corporate sites. That's one people don't think of a lot, but if you think of why corporations do websites, they do it to sell their products. And so if you go to the McDonald's website, believe me, you will not learn one thing about Wendy's and Burger King and all of that. It's all McDonald's all the time. So they're going to be talking about their own products. Now, I'm not talking about whether you can trust the information that's on there. That's not a copyright issue. Yeah, you know, they may mislead you. They may have a lot of, you know, trying to persuade you to buy their stuff, but that's not the copyright issue. The copyright issue is copying someone else's original work. So that's good. That's not a problem. What has been a problem is framing. You know, when you go to websites that have frames along the side or maybe the side and the top, we have had some cases that have actually been settled. They've not gone all the way to trial dealing with framing. Let me tell you about the most important one in the United States. We've had some in Europe also. Total News was a news aggregator. When you went to their website, you found their web page, which had frames around the left side and across the top. On the left side, there were buttons that said CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, all of those news gathering organizations. The frame that went across the top in big red letters flashing said Total News, Total News, Total News. So when you clicked on the CNN website, you got a button, you got CNN content, but you were always seeing Total News, Total News, Total News. And it was a confusion as to sponsorship case. And so it was settled with Total News agreeing that it would not do that, that it would make sure people knew when they clicked on CNN what they were getting was CNN content. Have you started sometimes seeing these banners that say you're now leaving our website? I think that has to do with this kind of decision. A very new answer that we've gotten recently is about deep linking. And now I'm talking about where you don't want to link to the first page of the McDonald's website, but you want to link way in to their new flash fried French fries page or whatever. And the answer from a case dealing with Ticketmaster is it's fine to deep link. And I think it might have been fine for nonprofit people to do it anyway, especially nonprofit educational institutions and libraries. But this was a commercial case which said, if you want to link to something that's offered by Ticketmaster, you do not have to link to their front page and see all their crappy advertising. You can link right into the concert or the museum tickets or whatever it is that you're looking for. I think that's a good decision. Why would that have come down? Well, Ticketmaster has the ultimate control. They can password protect everything but their front page if they want to do that. It's going to irritate the heck out of people, but they could do that. So they can control it that way. The other thing you need to watch is using logos. Now I'm going to say logos of corporations that are still in business. You may be using logos from old record labels where the company is gone. But if I want to say on my webpage I drink Diet Coke, I shouldn't use the Coca-Cola logo, unless Coca-Cola tells me I can, because they're really forced to come after you because that's not the way their trademarks are to be used. So that gives you a little help, I think, in creating some of these pages where you might include some of the recordings in which you're interested. Let me talk just a little bit about some of the recent legislation. This is not all that recent, but it has come up again, and that's the The digital transmission of sound recordings that I mentioned, that was added about 3 years ago to the Act, and it really hasn't been used until the MP3 cases over the last few months, but it has been in the Act for about 3 years. One that we are working with now a great deal is the new anti-circumvention provision, which was added in by the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which was just an amendment to the 1976 Act. Anti-circumvention says that if you create a device that circumvents any technological control a publisher or producer has put on their work, then that device makes you liable. Right now, individuals are not punished under the Act, but they may well soon be. There are hearings going on to see whether to implement the section that says publishers and producers can even go after individuals. And we have, again, the MP3 stuff ties into this, as does there's been a very recent case dealing with decrypting DVDs. Yeah. And the answer has been it was an anti-circumvention software device. And so they're going to lose on that. They did. The movie people will win. The other exemption that I think thought you might be interested in that was new was a performance exemption for small establishments. We've always had that in the Act, but now it defines it by square footage and goes on and on. It was put in because there were some very small bars and establishments that were visited by ASCAP and threatened, and so this was the reaction, the negative reaction to the heavy-handed ASCAP agents. Although I keep saying I'm going to be an ASCAP agent when I retire. I think it'd be fun to go to bars at night and listen to music. Tough job, right? Yeah. Okay, one of the issues that always comes up in copyright is whether there is a personal use exception or exemption. And you know what? The answer is we really don't know. There well may be, and we've got scholars who say absolutely, when you reproduce for personal use, there is an exemption. We have scholars that say no, it has to be fair use. And fair use doesn't say just because it's more convenient or because I want to do it. It really talks about scholarship and research and those sort of purposes. I tend to come down on the side that there is an exemption for personal use. And one of the reasons I get to that is really looking at things like the off-the-air exemption. You remember the Sony Betamax case from the early 1980s, which said when you videotape off-the-air for showing at home, that's fair use. There is not a similar case dealing with off-the-air audio recording, but all the experts say, yes, it's there too. We just never had a case that specifically dealt with that. The digital audio recording devices was an amendment in 1992, which basically killed the DAT technology. You all know that we allowed the music people to work on this for about 4 years, and then by the time they finally came forward with the statutory language, the technology was dead, really because of turning it over to them, I think, to write this statute. So what they've done is put a tax on equipment, but to say, if you make a personal copy, like reproduce a CD, et cetera, that's not a problem. So there are some real narrow exceptions for personal use. However, if you are trafficking in unauthorized sound recordings, then there's a problem. Now, one of the arguments that's been made is trafficking could also include just exchanging for no money. But normally when we talk about trafficking, it really has more of a commercial feel to it. But we haven't had much litigation under this newish section of the statute either. But I do think for personal use, for listening, et cetera, there probably is an exception. Educational use. I mentioned the guidelines on the educational uses of music. They do talk about reproducing portions of sound recordings for creating oral exercise, etc. Talks about recording student performances for purposes of criticism. It does not talk about selling those records then, and almost all educational institutions, like high schools, love to do that. Have the choir performance, and then they want to sell the copies of it. that actually violates the mechanical license provision for making records. So it's kind of interesting, been no litigation over it. I guess they figure that it's not gonna really take over the music business because nobody buys it, but the kids. There is a wonderful exemption in section 110.1 called the classroom exemption, which permits you to play music in the classroom, to perform it, as long as it is for educational purposes and not for entertainment. I don't think we have to worry about that with music as much as videos. What has happened with videos, especially in public schools, is it's a way to bribe the children if they're quiet all week. On Friday afternoon, you can watch videos to keep the little duffers quiet. And that is a public performance then because it is not part of instruction. But if the playing of music is part of instruction, that's not a problem. Library reserves have been another educational use of music, and the Music Library Association has very detailed guidelines about audio streaming and electronic reserves. They are pushing the envelope about as far as they can push it, and I admire them for doing that. Do I think it's absolutely fair use? No, I don't, quite frankly, but I'm glad they're doing it because I think that we do need to push the envelope with that. The reason I think it's a little bit dicey is they say, well, it doesn't make a copy and it's not a transmission. And you go, it's one or the other. You know, you're either making a copy or it is a transmission when you were doing that. You gotta make a choice. Okay, so those are some of the things. Library preservation, we have some new stuff coming up with library preservation. One question that's always been asked is whether Section 108 applies generally to sound recordings. The two preservation sections of the Act that have been around for a long time do now say you may even convert the format if it is an obsolete format, but it is a library that can do that. It's not just anybody. That's section 108B and 108C of the Act that allows us to do that. And I am very frequently asked about 78 recordings, especially about people wanting to preserve them rather than having to let students use those early recordings. And this says if that's an obsolete format, meaning that the equipment is not readily available on the market or is no longer commercially produced, and by readily available or reasonably available on the market, I guess you could make an argument about cost in that. There's no real help for us in the legislative history, but we are allowed to do that. And then a new section was added in by the Term Extension Act that says, hear that, in the last, stop, in the last, in the last, after the first 50 years of a work's term, in the last 20 years, a library may even distribute on the web this work after they've satisfied certain conditions, and it does include musical works with this. So, but you're already talking about something that's life plus 50 old before that kicks in. Now, what's going on with litigation? Well, the MP3 controversy is probably the big one. The first case that arose was last fall, the Recording Industry of America versus Diamond. And this case was brought under the wrong statute. It was brought under the Digital Audio Recording Act. And the court said, you know what? The Rio player is not a digital audio recording device, so you lose. And I kind of liked that because the publisher, music publishers and music record people had pushed so hard on the Audio Recording Act, they kind of got caught in it then because you define it too narrowly, you lose. That was the answer on that one. But what's happening now are really the suits against the MP3. The first one, UMG Recordings versus MP3.com, was really very interesting in that the suit really looked at whether, I'm mixing it up. It's the next one that does this. This was the conversion of MP3 recordings, claiming that this was a fair use, that it was transformative use. And the court said, no, it's not. It's simple copying. It is not fair use. The Napster case is the one in which Napster made a very clever argument, arguing that they were an online service provider, just like America Online. And so they could not be held liable if they were simply a passive conduit. And people were just using this and they happened to be infringing copyright. It's not Napster's fault. And the court said, wrong. It is Napster's fault. You are not a passive conduit. That is currently on appeal. Probably some of the most fun things that are going on are the Metallica and Dr. Dre suits. It's sort of interesting to see a group like Metallica claiming, you know, piracy and et cetera. Pardon?
Poverty.
Poverty, yeah, right, poverty. Because the very people that they are targeting and calling pirates have another name, fans. You know, they're called fans. And some bands, like the Grateful Dead, have been very successful with saying, yes, you may record us. Just come on into our concerts. We don't worry about it. Well, what has happened so far is that one of the first things Metallica did was to bring suit against four universities because students had been putting MP3 files of their recordings on the university's websites. The universities were very brave and took it down immediately. And so the suits against, the University of Southern California, the University of Illinois, New York University, and Indiana, that's right. Yeah, so all of those just right away said, we're gonna take those down. And again, it's that online service provider liability issue that the university just doesn't want to be liable for it. So they said, they're down, fine, we've got those down. So those suits have been dropped against the universities. Then what Metallica and Dr. Dre have asked is for Napster to report to them the names of all of the people who have used their software to record, and they turned in something like 300,000 names to them. Now, I just don't think it's going to be very successful to go against all of these individuals. Again, remember, you're not going to download any of this unless you happen to like those groups. And when they behave in this heavy-handed manner, it's going to change a lot of the relationship they have with their fans. There were people who were protesting and breaking all their Metallica CDs, et cetera. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. That's a good result. Yeah, I'm with you. The fact that Metallica gets pirated doesn't bother me just a whole lot. Yeah. And I didn't even know about Dr. Dre, but apparently a rapster. Didn't know about him, but another one who has a very good reputation, apparently, for, you know, always behaving in the right way, et cetera. So that's what's going on right now with the music business. The recording industry of America is behind, really, all of this. The law is on their side because of this anti-circumvention provision that says if you create software or device that circumvents technological controls, then you are liable, and that's what's happening. So the law is on their side. I don't necessarily think it's going to be a good result, but I think legally they are likely to win. I've told you that and forgot to say it. Okay, the future. I don't really know what's going to happen in the future, of course, but I can tell you this, copyright holders will continue to try to expand their rights. I think that is pretty clear. We have seen this through a variety of actions, license agreements with containing many more restrictions on use than we have seen before. Circumvention technologies, anti-circumvention technologies, but technologies that wrap these works and encryption controls or other kinds of black boxes. I think that is developing more and more. We're going to see that. There are legislative battles where we have librarians and educators on one side with our huge amounts of money arguing against the recording industry of America, Disney, Viacom, and the big publishing conglomerates, which are mostly European today. And we're seeing battles on the world front with treaties. And the trouble is, those of us who are users' rights advocates find ourselves simply outgunned. The one thing we can do is write letters. And I did hear the chief legal counsel for the Association of American Publishers say, if it comes to a letter-writing campaign, the librarians will win. Yay! That we can do. We can sure write letters. Okay, let me stop there, and we can turn up the lights, and I'll answer questions.
Why they seem to be so intent on maintaining control
I have no answer for it. It seems absolutely peculiar to me. I wonder if they think they might reissue them and make money on them. Sure, I mean, no. It is nonsensical, isn't it?
Unless it just gets swept in and nobody's paying attention to that. I just don't understand it.
I'm with you. I don't understand it either.
It's the foot in the door. Give them an inch and they'll take a mile.
Yeah.
If it's legal for somebody to do something for themselves, is it legal for somebody to hire somebody to do that for them?
I suspect that it is legal for someone to hire. I mean, if I don't want to buy my own groceries, I can hire somebody to buy them for me. That's not illegal, so it should carry over.
Just as long as you make just the one copy.
And the use.
And if you are asked for another copy, then you do it over again instead of use a library copy you've made for client one.
Yes.
In non-music recordings, verbal, mm-hmm. there's a person that you are recording, and there's the recorder. If the person who's being recorded dies, leaves their, bequeaths everything to a trust,
mm-hmm.
who owns the copyright? The person who has the tape in their hand who made the recording, or the benefactors of that person's will?
You've actually got two copyrights being sort of mushed together. Now, if the person being recorded does not have a written text, they're just talking extemporaneously, then there is no copyright in their words. It has to be fixed, and it has to be fixed with the permission of the copyright owner. So if you're just talking and somebody happens to record you, that doesn't count as fixation. When you have the tape being made and it's by the permission of the person being recorded, then there is a copyright in their words. Who owns it? Probably the author still owns it, the person who's being recorded. So the person taping is just doing it at the request or at the permission of the author.
What if it hasn't been paid for?
Doesn't really matter whether it's been paid for. Some of us do things not for money, like speak to you guys.
If you make a compilation of advertisements of, say, record companies, are advertisements free?
No, advertisements are copyrighted as graphic works. They sure are. But again, if you're talking about especially historical, then the advertising company may be long gone. So it may be worth taking the risk.
With the advertising company and not the company for whom the advertising.
It depends. You'd have to look at the contract between the two groups. Yeah. It's very complicated because it might have been a work for hire where the copyright belonged to the record company, or it may have been that the advertising company held the copyright.
Can you tell me where I would look in the copyright law for what you told me?
Where you would find it? There's nothing. There's nothing real specific. You just have to read this whole little book.
Right.
Yes.
My question concerns library preservation.
Uh huh. If you make a preservation copy and you followed section 108 C or D, B or C, it's an unpublished work, or if it's a published work, B, no, you can use that copy for interlibrary loan if you want to. What you can't do is if one of the three copies you get to make under the statute is a digital copy, that can be used only within the premises of the library. Stupid, isn't it? It's what the Act says.
Copy. How does that then play out?
Congress really screwed up this one, I think. I think what they were, only this one, right. No, I think what they were trying to say was, you may not take a copy that, make a digital copy and put it on a network. What they said was digital copy. And so that means if the original work was a CD and you preserve it by making another CD, that is a digital copy. I think that's not what they meant on something that starts out in digital format. I think that's what they mean. But if you make a digital copy that is your copy you're going to keep in the library and you want to make an analog copy and loan that, you sure can. But you only get to make three over the whole life of the copyright.
Okay.
No, only within the premises. That was added in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So it doesn't even mean on the campus.
Do you want to discuss the definition of premises?
Yeah. There's nothing in the act. I mean, what does premises usually mean? It means within the library buildings. You know, I think it can mean more than one building, but it means library. It does not mean on the campus. Yeah. Isn't that just ridiculous? Here, well, the reason we go to digital is so that you're not place bound, and they inserted place. That just doesn't make sense.
Or you just make a library annex room in every place on campus.
Yes. I said that I had heard representatives of ASCAP and BMI say that, but they are the performance people. They're not the recording industry of America. I've not heard the RIAA speak on it at all. I would recommend that if you're willing to take a little bit of risk, you go ahead and do it. If you're not, contact the RIAA. Yeah.
In the case of the work that is by a governmental entity.
Federal government entity.
Videos that are produced by the state of Florida for educational purposes that are then mastered by a production company that then claims copyright.
Uh-huh.
All that money has been grant funded and you're supposed to be able to duplicate.
States are free to claim copyright in their works if they want to, and the contract the state of Florida has with this company may permit that private company to claim copyright. It's a real bad idea, I might add, but they can do that. Because this covers only federal agencies.
What about broadcasts of stations which are no longer on the air? Who owns the rights to those?
Well, you know, when a publisher or a broadcaster or anybody goes out of business, they don't just disappear. It seems like they do, but someone buys their properties just like they buy their office furniture. So someone has probably purchased those. It may be another company in the area, another broadcaster in the area. It might be a conglomerate like the ABC affiliates. It might be something like that. So it's hard to say. Now, if it really did just disappear, then there just didn't anybody to own it. But the likelihood is someone did buy the copyrights.
Well, they might not even know they own it.
Yeah, they might not even know they own it. Yeah. So maybe you're better to go ahead and use it and not ask, is what you're saying, right?
What about heirs? So do heirs have automatic rights?
Heirs are treated just like like the author. It's life of the author plus 70 years. 70 years means heirs. They get exactly what the author had.
Because it's like some companies' holdings end up with the heirs.
Mm-hmm.
If the company went under and the family just kept its assets.
Yes. If they kept the assets, the heirs kept it, they're treated just like the original owner.
I understand some of that drove the last copyright extension. Important heirs of important people's works.
Like Disney, perhaps.
And I think an argument against that could be made that the author was really the primary beneficiary of their works, and it's getting way out of hand as far as how many subsequent reaping that reward. And I wonder if you see that there's any possibility of any of this being changed or pulled back on.
There's a slight possibility of it being pulled back on. I agree with you entirely. The whole purpose of awarding copyright is because you encourage creativity that way. Now, how does giving your heirs something for 70 years encourage your creativity? You are dead. I mean, you know, you are dead. Yeah. So, you know, how many generations later? The reason I say that there is a chance of pulling back on it is there is a constitutional challenge to the Term Extension Act. There is a publisher called Eldred Press, and the owner of it is Mr. Eldred, E-L-D-R-E-D. I don't know why he didn't use the same thing for his press. It's Eldred Press. And his whole business was taking works as soon as they went into the public domain and publishing them electronically, doing a lot of hyperlinking in them and such. And he was ready to take some works from 1923. You know, he's all geared up to do that. And then the Copyright Term Extension Act passed. And so he's saying it is unconstitutional. He unfortunately lost the first stage of the suit, but it is on appeal, and he has some very important people helping him.
The,
what we wonder.
Yeah,
it's in the Constitution. And it says for limited times, and if you can keep tacking years onto it, what's limited times, a millennium? You know, it's already so long. Well, I was going to tell you who is helping Mr. Eldred. Have you ever heard of Larry Lessig? You know who he is? Yeah, faculty member from Harvard, special master in the Microsoft antitrust case. Yeah, he's volunteered his time with Mr. Eldred. So maybe there is a chance that could be overturned. But, you know, I wouldn't hold my breath on it, I guess I'd say.
But at present time, anything prior to 1923 is fair game,
yes,
reissued.
Published in the United States.
Published in,
yes.
And anything after isn't.
Not sound recordings. Because remember, sound recordings were not even protected until 1972. By some states, not all states. Some states protected them, right? But they were not protected by federal copyright.
My question also pertains to that. Now, I understand that there are these state laws that do something similar to copyright for material of that period, and that, of course, because they're not related to copyright, public domain is not an issue.
Right.
So my question is, from the perspective of the state laws, is there anything to distinguish, say, a recording of a Sousa march from 1968 and from 1890 as far as the level of protection?
Not really. There would be if it was 1978, but not when you use 1968. Yes?
Didn't I read something a couple weeks ago about the Lowridge case settled against MP3 in favor of the five major record companies?
Yeah, that's the ones I was giving you, some of those. Yeah, oh yeah, that's what I'm saying. The record companies are winning those. And they're brought in the name of record companies, but it is the recording industry of America that's behind it all. Just like when the publishers sue, it's the individual publishers, but it's the Association of American Publishers that's managing the litigation. Yes?
Recordings for those federal copyright protection for sound recordings, how does the copyright on the underlying musical work
Well, the copyright and the underlying musical work is protected by federal copyright and has been since 1831. So the underlying musical composition is treated just like anything else. It's only the sound recording part of it.
But that means you have to pay the rights on the music, but you can't be forbidden from issuing.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you're going to have to pay. Well, if it's in the public domain.
No,
but
I'm saying if it's
still under copyright,
you Harry Fox or whatever.
Yeah, you got to pay the mechanical license, but that's it.
How would you find which of those earlier recordings are in the public domain and which are covered on the state register?
It is very difficult. It is very difficult because of the only registration system was the federal one. And so what I advise people to do is to talk with Harry Fox to see, you know, some of those big agencies. That's about the best advice we can give. A long time from now, it's going to be easier because the Copyright Office records are all from 1978 forward are on their website. And you can see who owns the work, when was it registered, that sort of thing. But for the earlier ones, you really can't. Yes?
The vast majority of early recordings were made in New York. My understanding was that New York had fairly tight laws.
They did. That's correct.
Therefore, please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm over there, that most early recordings, if they have a successor corporation or owner, are in fact protected.
Because they are, if they were produced in New York, that's correct.
New Jersey?
Would they, well, no,
I don't know.
Wait a minute. If they're protected in New York and you make a copy and you sell it outside of New York,